Hello and welcome to a special Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au. Tonight we head directly to the Sydney Opera House, where Julia Gillard has just given her first extended interview since losing the Prime Ministership and leaving politics. She is in conversation with journalist and commentator Anne Summers, editor and publisher of the online magazine Anne Summers Reports. Big Ideas will bring you the full interview and as much of the audience Q&A as we have time for. This is essentially a delayed live broadcast from the Opera House, so please excuse a few very minor audio glitches which came down the line to us. With no further ado, let me take you now to the concert hall at the Sydney Opera House and Anne Summers and Julia Gillard.
I'm sure you all recognise that song. Respect. Respect. Something that's been sadly lacking in our political system in recent years. It's my very great pleasure and honour to be able to welcome Julia Gillard here this evening. As we know, her first public appearance since the night of June 26th, when she stopped being our Prime Minister. Since that time... Before I start the questions, there's been plenty of opportunity for expressions of emotion, don't worry. But I'd like to just acknowledge you, the audience. I mean, this is phenomenal. I don't know about you, Julia, but this is certainly my debut at the Opera House.
Mine too.
And to be here in front of an audience of 2,600 people all around us, we could have, this event sold out in hours, as you know. We could have sold it out probably 10 times over. And again in Melbourne tomorrow night, we're going to be talking to another 2,000 people, in addition to all of those who are watching it on television and who will be listening to it in coming days on broadcasts and podcasts and what have you. So I know that there are people in the room tonight who've flown in from Perth, who've flown from Brisbane, who've bussed down from Newcastle, who've given... and who couldn't resist taking photographs of themselves in the bus and tweeting them as they came. So this is quite an occasion, quite an occasion. I want to thank you all for being here, being part of this incredible night. But the very first question I want to ask you tonight, Julia Gillard, is... Three months. Disappeared from our nightly TV news, and we've only just seen a few glimpses of you in the last couple of days, as well as your tweets on election night. People have said to me, how is she? Is she okay? So that's my question tonight. Are you okay? Are you okay?
Yes, Anne, I am okay, and I should say better for being here, so thank you very much. Thank you.
I venture to say that when it comes to doing opinion polls, probably nobody in this room was asked what they thought. yesterday was your birthday.
Yes, it was.
you flew back in from New York yesterday morning. You've been in America for a week. You flew back in, so I guess you haven't yet had time to engage in much birthday celebrations.
I managed to have a wonderful birthday celebration. Oh. Flying back in from the States, at least it's an easier journey to get back into the time zone. So I flew in yesterday morning to Melbourne and spent the day with Tim at our home in Altona. We are moving to Adelaide, but we're still in Altona now. And fans of Altona, that's good. actually, our Altona residence is on a Hobson's Bay walking tour, so periodically when I come home, there are 40 or 50 people gathered taking photos, unfortunately, of the weeds in the front yard. But Tim cooked up a wonderful barbecue lunch, and we had a couple of friends around, including a friend who's very dear to me and has had a very big battle with breast cancer, which she's on the winning side of at the moment, and her hair is back, and that was just lovely. We had a great day.
So this is the same Tim Matheson that you allegedly have separated from?
Yes, this is the one and the same Tim Matheson. There's only one Tim. And that, I think, is a case study even post-politics in some of the foibles of the Australian media. Unbeknownst to me, it was reported in Women's Day that we were, you know, in some sort of trouble. So I wasn't even, you know, asked by Women's Day what comment I might have on this matter. And I guess you expect the women's magazines to be, you know, putting in a bit of gossip. What I didn't quite expect was this to appear in the Australian Financial Review. not a matter, as I can understand, related to the balance of stocks and shares on the ASX, and not something we were ever given a proper opportunity to comment on. It was known I was in New York, that was reported, and, you know, a call at 2 a.m. New York time seeking comment, and by the time that call was returned at 6 a.m. New York time, it was too late and it was going in the paper anyway. So unfortunately, that's the foibles of the Australian media.
So even as a private citizen, no longer a politician, let alone Prime Minister, you still don't have the ability to have your life treated privately or accurately?
Neither, and I'd understand some continuing public interest, but accuracy would be desirable.
Good idea. Look, we're going to be talking in some detail tonight about your Prime Ministership, what you see as your legacy, but before we do that, I think we want to get straight to the nitty-gritty of the subjects that I think all of us are desperate to hear you talk about, and the two big questions, I guess, the two big things that defined your Prime Ministership were, one, the way in which your party disposed of you on the 26th of June this year, and secondly, the disgraceful and sexist treatment that you had to endure at the hands of so many people in this country. And so we're going to talk about those two things first. So let's get straight into the 26th of June, that night, the night. A pretty close vote, 57 to 45, just a 12, a difference of 12, seven votes in it. Were you surprised at the result?
Time I walked into the party room meeting, I'd known during the course of the day that I was in tremendous difficulty, and obviously you make the calls and you check your support, and it was increasingly clear to me, and I should say to Wayne Swan, who is in the audience tonight, I think it is fair to say, Wayne, isn't it? It was increasingly clear to us that we were in tremendous difficulty. So by the time we walked into the party room meeting, we knew it would be close, but that we were going to come out on the losing side.
So you really
of it.
Went down to the wire, though. You didn't know until you actually walked into the room?
Oh, we knew we were going to lose. It was a question of by how much.
I must have been, you must have felt pretty gutted that so many people that you would have regarded as rusted on Gillard supporters decided to switch sides?
I was in some people's decisions, but more than anything else, I was worried about what the whole thing said for the political. Yes, of course, you know, there's a range of personal emotions, there's some frustration, there's some anger. You know, we'd implemented really big reforms. I got into politics to change the country for the better. So, of course, I was hungry to do more of that and to have the opportunity to do more of it. So, yes, there was all of that swirl of emotions, but there was also this sense of what does it say about Labor culture? What does it say about the kind of political party we're going to be in the future? And so I quickly concluded after the meeting that the best thing I could do is accept that that was the judgment that had been made, and to give a gift of silence to the Labor Party during the course of the campaign to do absolutely nothing. But once the campaign was over, I did just, you know, once want to speak, hopefully forcefully, about what I thought about internal Labor culture, and I did that in the Guardian piece that I wrote.
When, What do you say to those people, and there still are people who say this, I've had the people say this to me just in the last week, that that you stabbed Kevin Rudd in the back in June 2010, and what he did to you was basically just the reverse or the mirror image of what you'd done to him. How do you answer that accusation?
Look, I think that accusation sort of settled into the political narrative. Mm. Of course, my view of this is to ask your leader to have a leadership ballot. That's legitimate, to do things continuously that undermine the Labor Party and a Labor government, then of course that shouldn't be done by anyone. That's why I am not going to make it so difficult for a leadership ballot to occur, but I do think that it's great that there is a leadership ballot happening now that party members are getting a say in, and I think that that's, you know, one spark of light that is revitalising our party culture.
So the key difference was that you asked for a ballot, he didn't.
I think the key difference is every day I was Deputy Prime Minister, I spent all of my time doing everything I could to have the Labor government prosper.
So what did... I mean, we all know now... you can no longer deny the truth of it. It's been extensively reported. Some of those involved have even talked about it. That you were, you know, ruthlessly stalked for 3 years. You were undermined. You were denigrated by your colleagues in concert with some people in the media. And that there was an attempt to delegitimise your authority and your role. And ultimately that led to the circumstances which enabled the polls to provide the justification for what happened. I mean, how did you endure 3 years of that? If you're in a normal workplace, you'd be entitled to go to the boss and say, listen, you know, listen, mate, I'm not going to put up with this. You can't do that when you're Prime Minister, can you?
Yeah. I'm not sure who I would have gone to. Maybe I could have gone to the Governor-General, in which case I probably wouldn't have said, listen, mate. I may have said, would Your Excellency consider, or something like that. Looking back on it, I mean, it was kind of, the perfect political storm. The perfect storm in the sense of emerging from the 2010 election with a minority government, which enabled a very hard-hitting opposition campaign to daily question the legitimacy of the government, and that is what the then opposition leader, Mr Abbott, and his team did. Then all of the theatrics that went with a minority parliament. I mean, in reality, it was a very productive parliament and a lot got done.
We're going to come to some of that in a moment.
Yes, but because, you know, you couldn't tell in advance exactly what was going to happen in the House of Representatives. This was endlessly fascinating and sort of breathlessly reported. And then you had the sort of wildcard element of gender being the first female Prime Minister, and then internal instability in the Labor Party. So it all came together to create this very difficult environment. For me, you couldn't each and every day get up and say to yourself, gee, I wish I'd had a different hand of cards, you know, I've been dealt the deck I've got, and so with the deck I've got, what's the best use I can make of it? And I think we very productively used the time that we had to create things that will endure. We didn't get everything right, and one of the things about not being there anymore is you have the luxury of time and perhaps sometimes the torture of time to, you know, do the what-ifs and play out the alternate scenarios in your head. But I think given the degree of difficulty, whilst there are some things you are always going to think, I could have done that better, I could have done that differently, we just did get a lot done that is changing this nature for the nation for the better right now.
Well, speaking of... Speaking of what-ifs, that night that you drove to Government House to see Her Excellency and to recommend a new person be sworn in as Prime Minister, did it occur to you to recommend anyone but Kevin Rudd? there was some talk about the dog,
yes,
Reuben the dog.
I know that there are some of my former staff members in the audience tonight, and it is true that I did have a glass of red wine post the press.
Just the one?
At that point. Had a glass of red wine post the press conference before going to the Governor-General's, and there may have been some suggestions over that glass of red wine that Reuben, who, as people probably know, there is someone who tweets Reuben for PM, that we could have made that the most important Twitter account on the planet, but I stopped short of doing that. And recommended Kevin. It's also true, Anne, that after the visit to the Governor-General, and particularly with Wayne Swan here, I do need to acknowledge that there was much more
alcohol consumed. not too many wowsers in the house tonight by the sound of it. Well, speaking about that night, I mean, probably, most of us had gone through what you'd just gone through and had been suffered that sort of comprehensive personal rejection, and suddenly you were no longer the Prime Minister. I mean, given all that, how most of us probably would have wanted to just bury ourselves in a bucket of whiskey or wine or whatever your poison is. But what you did that night was quite extraordinary. I just want to ask you how you found it in yourself to go into your office, which is what was going to be your office for another 10 minutes or something, and write that letter that you wrote to Joanne McCarthy. Joanne McCarthy, of course, for those in the audience who don't know, is the journalist from the Newcastle Herald who did all that incredible reporting of sexual abuse against children by the Catholic Church in the Hunter Valley region. And her reporting led to the Royal Commission. I mean, she had written to you apparently a few weeks before, a handwritten letter. So what on earth made you think that night, of all the things in the world I've got to do before I leave the job, I'm going to write to Joanne?
Joanne had come to figure very prominently in my thinking. Not that we know each other well or that we've spent, oceans of time together, we haven't. But Sharon Grierson, who was then the member for Newcastle, was very much, very good woman, very much in contact with Joanne. And, everything that was happening in Newcastle was at the forefront of my thinking as we decided to move to the stage of having a national royal commission. So she'd been a real impetus for what I think will be a very profound change about how our nation thinks about keeping our children safe. And she'd sent me correspondence, and I'd wanted to answer it, and knew that if this wasn't the moment I answered it, then the moment was going to go by. If there'd been one thing I could have done in that moment which would have sealed everything about school funding, I would have done it too. If there had been one thing that could have meant that the National Disability Insurance Scheme was instantaneously rolled out, I would have done it. But those things weren't open to me. But it was open to me to make sure that I wrote back, and so I did.
Good on you. Let's talk now about Julia Gillard, Australia's first woman Prime Minister, and the treatment that you endured as a woman. In fact, just a week ago, speaking on British television, Kate Blanchett said, speaking about you, it was quite shocking the way she was treated as a woman. And I think all of us in this room probably, we know what was done, we know what was said about you, we know some of the horrible images. And I guess the question that I want to ask you, never had the chance to ask you before, is, to what extent did you know about this stuff, or were you protected from it, from your staff, from seeing it, or were you aware of these gross email Photoshop pictures of you, these horrible cartoons of you wearing dildos, these disgusting images that were everywhere all over the internet? Did you know about them?
Yes, I knew about them, but I also chose not to focus on them, and I think that was probably the healthier option.
But how did you feel? I know people have said they cried.
Yeah.
Seeing them, because they cried not just for you, but obviously for you, but also they cried for us, that we could have reached a level of political discourse in this country where it was okay to draw you, a woman, but you, the Prime Minister, in that way. I mean, it must have been very, very upsetting, surely.
I would have said more like murderous rage, really.
Okay.
And so for my personal liberty, it's probably a good thing that I didn't focus on them. I mean, and I do think, you know, and at the end of the day, yes, it happened to me, but it's not, you know, about me. It's about all of us, about women and about the kind of society we want to be for all of us. I think maybe we can drop the murderous, but we should feel a sense of rage about it, because it's only through something that really spurs you on to action that it's going to change.
But, I mean, did you find it kind of surprising that the political discourse had reached a point in this country? I mean, did you put it down to the fact that it was because there was a woman in the job, or was it because politics in general has become so horrific, and social media obviously enables every person in the country to be a commentator and what have you if they choose to? I mean, how much of it do you think was to do with, not you personally necessarily, but you as a woman, and how much of it is just, you know, politics has gone absolutely toxic?
I think it would have been there even if it hadn't been for the new media, and that's kind of a depressing thing to say. Mm. I was surprised by it. I mean, I'd had, you know, issues related to my gender before I became Prime Minister. I mean, the deliberately barren comment and all of that kind of stuff had happened before I was Prime Minister. But it seemed to me it was like having the first woman Prime Minister let out this wellspring of enthusiasm from women and from many men, the sort of people who would, you know, just canter over to me, including lots of men, and say, I don't even vote for you, but would you sign this for my daughter, because I want to give it to her when I get home. Mm. So this sort of wellspring of, you know, sort of inspiration, and finally, and it does mean my daughter can grow up in a society where she'll be treated equally. So there was that, but there was also this underside of sexism, you know, really violent, ugly sexism that came forward. And I think it finds easier expression because of the social media, but I think it would have been there anyway. And I had thought we were beyond that, and it's kind of depressing that we're not. But at least we know exactly where the balance of it is now, and what more remains to be done for women to be truly equal. And I think even people who may not remember me as a good Prime Minister, I think for whoever the next woman is, there will be a bit of a, you know, pause, breathe, whatever else this female Prime Minister does, we don't want it to be like that for her again.
We hope.
And there'll be a stop.
People behind you too. Which brings me to this in the round is something we're trying to get used to, so please excuse the backs. Maybe we'll do that in a little while. I think that might mess things up. Which brings me, of course, to the speech that defined your prime ministership, your famous sexism and misogyny speech, and there are many things you said in that speech that the many things I can quote from the speech, the one thing that really I think was so instructive was when you said you were standing obviously at the dispatch box and you were pointing down to the chair in which you normally sat, and you were saying, you know, there were things said about me that would never be said about a man sitting in this chair. And that to me was such a powerful statement, because it was saying, okay, this is not about me being Labor or me introducing a carbon tax or me being, you know, anything to do with policy. This was to do with me being a woman. And that speech resonated around the world. And let's not even think about the reaction of the Hamburg Press Gallery, who just simply, plain and simple, didn't get it. but around the world, millions, thousands, if not millions of people got it. Can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to speak the way you did on that day, what it was that got you going, and why you did it?
I can. I've actually kept the handwritten notes that I wrote while I was in the chamber, so I'm not sure what I'll ever do with them, but I do still have
archives.
them. For when I first became Prime Minister, I thought to myself then, I don't need to put in the foreground being a woman. Of course, I want to speak for women. Of course, I want to govern for women. Of course, I want to do good things for women. But I didn't think I needed to put it right in the foreground because it was just so obvious, and you know, it was going to be commented. It was going to be commented on, and it was going to be so much of what came to define my prime ministership without me constantly pointing to it. And then as, you know, the days in office went on, it just seemed to me increasingly I was getting the burden of this, that sort of, you know, misogynist underside, and really none of the benefits that could come with being the first female Prime Minister because I wasn't putting it in the foreground. And you know, so all of this sort of swirled round. Obviously, I did want to speak to women, and we did some policies which were terrific for women, equal pay, social and community services workers and the like. But this was all, you know, in and around me, in my head, in the environment, in our politics. And then we got to that parliamentary debate, and I must admit it was a, you know, sort of crack point in my thinking, that I thought, after everything I've had to see on the internet, after all the gendered abuse that I've seen in newspapers, that has been called at me across the dispatch box, now of all things, I've got to listen to Tony Abbott lecture me about sexism. Like, and that's what, you know, gave the sort of emotional start to the speech of I will not. And once I'd started, it just sort of got a life of its own.
Did it, Emma?
You're listening to a special Big Ideas on RN and online. Julia Gillard is giving her first major interview since losing the Prime Ministership and leaving politics. She's in conversation at the Sydney Opera House with journalist Anne Summers from Anne Summers Reports. You can podcast the entire version of this discussion, including the full audience Q&A, from the Big Ideas website at abc.net.au/radionational. And you can tweet us at RN Big Ideas. Let's return to the conversation with former Prime Minister Julia Gillard.
But then, of course, that very same Mr. Abbott accused you of using the gender card. Now, why is it that this expression is used whenever women stick up for their rights?
Oh, I wish I knew. It just amazes me that we can be having this infantile conversation about gender wars, and so you really, you know, feel like just, and it's, you know, Mr. Abbott, but it is far broader than the current Prime Minister. You just feel like saying, well, if it was your daughter and she was putting up with sexist abuse at work, what would you advise her to do? Because apparently, if she complains, she is playing the victim and playing gender wars, and if she doesn't complain, then she really is a victim. So, in your analysis, what does this woman do? And we've got to be able to say, you know, strongly to women and girls, you've got a right to an environment that treats you with respect, treats you as an equal, and raising your voice about that isn't starting a war, it isn't playing the victim, it's just asking for what simply is right.
Equality. Let's move on to talk about your Prime Ministership. Now, there are two things that no one can take from you. One is that you are one of only 28 people who've been Prime Minister of this country since Federation. You served 3 years and 3 days, which in fact was longer than our first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, longer than Harold Holt. Okay, he drowned. But longer than Billy McMahon. On your own side of politics, longer than Kevin Rudd and longer than Gough Whitlam. So of the 28 prime ministers we've had, including Tony Abbott, you are ranked number 14 in terms of tenure. So that's not a bad innings. Secondly, the other thing that no one can take away from you is that you are and always will be Australia's first woman Prime Minister. In your 3 years and 3 days in the job, you achieved an extraordinary amount. I mean, I guess 590 pieces of legislation, many of them fiercely contested despite the hung parliament. I guess my question is, why was it that you had such trouble communicating what a great job you were doing?
Well, I wouldn't have minded knowing the answer to that earlier too. I think, once again, that's a mix of things. Can you always be better at your craft? Should we have been better at our craft? Then maybe the answer to that is yes. But, you know, I think across the government we had some remarkable communicators, and fortunately some of them are staying in Labor politics. I know, for example, Tanya Plibersek is here tonight. I think Tanya genuinely is one of the most gifted communicators in Australian politics. So, you know, yes, it's something to do with us, but it's also, I think, a lot to do with the, you know, changing media environment. And I think that this is something across democratic politics in Western countries. It's not just us, it's President Obama, it's Prime Minister Cameron, all trying to work out what is the rhythm with which you govern, given this media age where things are instantaneous, which means the truth can be instantaneously given to thousands and thousands of people in a way that you never could before. But in an age in which lies and half-truths and odd political claims and silly slogans can also get automatic and widespread currency. And I think that that is a challenge for all of us to think through. I think we live in a remarkable age which could truly enrich our democracy, but we haven't actually found the way of using these new tools to do that yet.
We're going to come to some of your policies and your legacy in a moment, but just want to ask you a slightly more kind of mundane question. As I've been sort of walking around Sydney the last few days, just on the streets and in shops, people have been sort of coming up to me and saying, now you're going to be talking to Julia Gillard, would you please ask her? So we'd be here for hours, you know, to get through all of the questions. But one question that a number of people said to me, that they really would love to be able to understand what it's actually like being the Prime Minister and doing the job and being in the lodge and all of that stuff. So I told somebody I'd ask you this question. Could you just, I know there's no such thing as an average day in politics, but just can you sort of construct a sort of average day in Canberra? You wake up in the morning in the lodge and you're going to end up in question time and doing whatever you do. Can you just tell us, you know, do you get breakfast in bed from the staff? how does it work?
How does it work? Well, a parliamentary day, I mean, no 2 days were the same, and so you could wake up anywhere, you know, Canberra, somewhere around Australia, overseas, but a parliamentary day. I'd get up in Canberra.
What time?
Oh, well, it would depend on whether I had morning TV, but sometimes as early as before 5 a.m. Sometimes you get the luxury of, you know, the clock being closer to 6 than, you know, but early, always get up early. Get across the 4 newspapers that you could get in Canberra that early in the morning as quickly as possible. I found out since leaving the lodge that the woman, Margaret, whose job it was to make sure the newspapers were there as early as humanly possible, used to spend a lot of time agonising what order to put them in because she'd be desperately trying to put the one with the nicest news on top. And there just wasn't one with the nicest news.
Were there some days when the papers got lost?
No, never. I always looked at the newspapers and then would, you know, every parliamentary day would get makeup professionally done. Tim would do my hair, but get makeup professionally done, which all sounds very luxurious and indulgent until you have to do it every day, and then it's not luxurious and indulgent anymore. And then I would get into Parliament and have my first meeting with Wayne and Albo to set up our tactics for the day, which had a pretty familiar format. You know, papers are crap. Yep, they are, Wayne. Polls are crap. Yep, that's true too. Yep. Right, what do you reckon we're going to do today? And then we would get stuck into planning for question time. And, you know, then in that time in between that first meeting and going to question time, you know, you might just be on internal meetings and internal paperwork, but some days just remarkable things would happen, and you'd get the opportunity, as I did, to apologise for the nation, to people who had been the victims of forced adoptions, and to participate in that moment. Then whatever else was happening in Parliament that day, I'd get on an adrenaline-fuelled surge between 12 and 2 to get ready for question time.
What would you do? You wouldn't get on your bike and ride up Red Hill, would you?
No.
So what would you do to gear yourself up?
Happily leave that to Mr Abbott as his pre-question time routine. The staff would have spent a lot of time working out what was in the newspapers. Fortunately, the opposition was pretty predictable, and so what they were going to ask would come out of the newspapers, and so you'd get all of those bad stories from the morning, and then they'd go and get the answers for them, and they would be in my question time folder, and so you'd have to get across all of that and memorise it by question time. Then you'd go and do...
That's all.
You'd go and do that for the hour and a bit that it took. And then a lot of my time was devoted to parliamentary business because of the minority parliament. I actually had to have the Prime Minister's office rewired so that the division bells rang in the Prime Minister's office, because before that they didn't, because there was just no expectation the Prime Minister was going to waste his time going to a division. But I couldn't afford to miss a division because we, you know, lose a bill, we'd lose government. So, you know, I had to rewire it. So negotiations with the independents, making sure that the parliamentary processes were working, took a lot of time. You have a lot of evening functions in Parliament. I mean, all the great and the good and the various lobby groups and causes come to Parliament and have their annual events. Some of them are a grand delight. Some you're kind of sneaking a look at the watch and hoping you might be able to, you know, get an early night. Whether or not I could get an early night depended on whether or not Mr Abbott had something on and we could pair and both leave Parliament. Otherwise, I would be there until the Parliament ceased to sit, which some nights could be very late indeed.
At 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, sometimes when we were pushing stuff through at the end of sessions.
I've got to speed things up a bit. I'm looking at the clock. But on the night of that wonderful speech you gave on June 26, you nominated as your legacy, the things that you were proudest of, you nominated health reform, a price on carbon, disability care, education reform, the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse, and foreign policy. You nominated the strengthened alliances between the United States and China, and also the developing relationship with India. What of these things, or of anything else in your legacy that you want to tell us about, what was the hardest to achieve?
I think the hardest to achieve was the new architecture with China.
Really?
Not in the sense...
And what do you mean by architecture?
I should be clearer than that. Mm. We have secured, and we are one of the few nations on earth that now has a standing commitment that the Australian leader and Chinese leader will meet once a year, and that is very, very significant, very significant for us. Mm. And it took a more than 12-month strategy, piece by piece, officials working. Wayne actually played a role in a visit to China. Of course, the foreign minister, Bob Carr, did too. And it ultimately had to be sealed in a phone call between me and the Premier to make enough space so that when I got to China, there would be no doubt that we would be able to get this done. So it was a lot of patient effort, but I was very proud of it.
Mm. And you said when you took over the job of Prime Minister that foreign policy wasn't your thing. Well, that changed pretty quickly, didn't it? It turned out to be you were quite good at it.
Yeah, look, I made a statement that, you know, I'll always feel more comfortable in a classroom mucking around with kids. And, you know, that was my way of saying the thing that brought me into politics was education and opportunity and, you know, not foreign policy, not that I wasn't interested in our world. Of course I was interested in our world, but it wasn't the thing that propelled me into politics. But for all of its, you know, difficulties and, you know, I mean, foreign policy, incredibly complex, and for all of the machinery that goes around at the Department of Foreign Affairs and everything else that supports a Prime Minister, it actually comes down to, you know, two people in a moment, often across cultures. Can you find a way of relating to each other in a meaningful way as human beings, or are you going to sit there and read through the talking points that an official has given you? And so for a lot of it, it is, you know, find a way to have a joke, find a way to create a connection so that you can, you know, move beyond, gee, you're my 20th meeting today, to actually, this is a human being, well, I'm going to respond
to. You obviously achieved that in spades, as it were, with Barack Obama. Well, and he got on so, clearly got on so well. You joked, you laughed, you had your arms around each other in photographs, you played football in the... all of us watching you play football in the Oval Office, oh, my God, if that breaks one of those amazingly valuable...
It could have gone badly.
Yes.
Well, actually, the whole relationship could have gone badly because the first time we met each other, which was just in a casual encounter in a multilateral meeting, so not a formal bilateral where you're sitting down with all of the officials and all the rest of it, and he said to me, you know, I really envy, I can't do the American accent, won't even try, I really envy your question time, to which I said instantaneously, are you mad? And then the second it was out of my mouth went, boy, that was kind of a really dumb thing to say to the leader of the free world on first meeting. Fortunately, he laughed, which is, and I explained to him, question time, it's like, you know, an hour and a bit, 4 days a week, and Parliament sits 20 weeks a year, and you take 10 questions, and basically I take all of them, and people are screaming abuse at you as you're answering them, to which he had the good grace at the end of the conversation to go, I am mad. No, that just sounds... that sounds dreadful.
The other person in the American administration that you had a very good relationship with, of course, was Hillary Clinton, and you and she have had a number of meetings, and I think you saw her last week
in New York.
I know we're running out of time. We have to go to audience questions in a second, but can I just quickly ask you, do you want her to run?
Look, I said to you when we spoke for what became my last interview as Prime Minister, I wasn't sure what to wish for her. And I, in part, thought that because as I had seen her towards the end of her Secretary of State period, she looked so physically exhausted. And what really made me think that, and it's going to sound like a little thing, but I thought it was emblematic, whenever you see a photograph of her as a teenager, as a young woman, she's got the headband and the hair pulled back. And in her last period of Secretary of State, she'd turn up to meetings and she'd have the headband and the hair pulled back. And just, you know, when you're that tired, I know, you just go back to the things that you know and are most comfortable with. And it really is
speaking
of a... Oh, well, I I ended up, you know, if you could get a morning where you could, you know, pad round and just take a little bit more time and have an extra cup of coffee, I would do that. But I thought that said how deeply exhausted she was. And that's why I said to you I wasn't sure what to wish for her. But having seen her in New York, she looks terrific, she looks vibrant, she looks bright-eyed, she is full of ideas about politics, about our world, and very focused on empowerment for women and girls. And wouldn't it be fantastic to follow the first African-American president with the first woman president? And
we're going to go to audience questions in a moment, so anybody who'd like to ask a question, please make your way to the microphones. And I'm going to ask Julia one final question while you're doing that. And that is, Julia Gillard, what's next? You've already announced that you're moving your office to the University of Adelaide. You'll be the first Prime Minister to have an office in the university, which embodies your commitment to education. You've announced that you're going to be writing a book, writing your memoir. I'm sure we're all looking forward to that. Maybe we can come back and talk about that next year. Do you have anything else in store?
Yes, I do. So Tim and I and Reuben in round about mid-November will be moving to Adelaide. I'll take up the honorary professorship at Adelaide University. But I have just entered an arrangement with Brookings, which is one of the world's leading think tanks in Washington, to be a senior fellow working on global education issues.
Ask you what does that entail, but it seems everybody already knows. And given the number of people who are lined up at the...
It does mean I'll get to live in Adelaide, but I will be travelling to Washington very regularly.
A lot.
A lot.
Okay. So Katrina is going to now manage the questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have clearly some cues on either side of the hall tonight. And unfortunately, we won't be able to perhaps get to all of your questions. So we've got half an hour. And what I'll do is just ask you if you could please let us know your first name and where you're from, and then address the question to Julia. That'd be fabulous. So we'll start down here.
Well, good evening, Anne and Julia. My name is Nicola, and I'm from the Women's College at the University of Sydney. My question is this. Tony Abbott is the new Minister for Women. What advice do you have for him?
I think the advice I would have for Prime Minister Abbott is to reach across the partisan divide and ask Tanya.
Okay, and the next question, please.
Lance from Erskineville. Julia, those handwritten notes you kept for the misogyny speech, can I have them? Coming from Erskineville, the entrepreneur in me figures that he could do something with those.
Great, thank you very much.
I think I'll be keeping them just for a while and then I'll work out a good purpose for them, but I'm happy to take suggestions.
You can start tweeting them.
It's good, start tweeting them, not in my handwriting.
Hi, Julia, my name is Jamie. My question for you is, what's the best piece of advice that you've received?
The best piece of advice... Look, I think the best grounding I got really was in my family home. My mother and father were, by instinct, believers in equal opportunity. My, you know, two girls, my sister and I. I've sometimes reflected to myself, maybe if there'd been a son in the family, would it have been any different? Us, you know, aim high, do your best, look after others. But my father was also an incredibly calm person. As a psychiatric nurse, I think you had to be calm. And I think I picked some of that up from him. I think apart from that grounding, possibly some of the best advice I've had is, you know, along the way, don't if you're going to, like the one I've led, will ultimately kill you. Don't worry about those things. Just keep your eyes on the main things.
Thank you.
Hello, Julia. My name is Benjamin and I'm based here in Sydney. I have two questions, but they're both very quick. The first one is Bill Shorten or Anthony Albanese? And my second question is, of the sitting MPs currently there in Parliament, who do you think would make a good next female leader of the ALP?
Dorothy Dixon. Right.
I think I may have given you an indication of who I think is a very talented female Member of Parliament. The current Bill Albo contest, I'm actually not publicly stating a preference. I think it's more respectful for me to stay out of it and let them, and obviously I'll get a vote as a party member, but let them and the tens of thousands of party members work it out.
Great. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll go up behind us.
Jane Goodall from Toowoomba in Queensland. You were up against a leader of the opposition who repeatedly introduced censure motions calling you an embarrassment, dishonest, deceitful, incompetent, and the leader of government. That was a complete shambles. Now that this person is starting his own term as Prime Minister, I'm afraid I have another advice question. What would you like to advise him?
And they were some of the nicer things he said about me.
Well, I guess that's one of the questions that some people have asked me to ask you, Julia, and that is, what is it that he used to call across the dispatch box to you that only you could hear?
Oh, I'd actually have to say across the dispatch box, it wasn't current Prime Minister Abbott who was... Occasionally, he'd get involved, but more the people behind him. So Christopher Pine in particular, I would point to. Advice for Prime Minister Abbott, it is, it's a big step from criticising what you think is wrong to working out and implementing what you think is right. On current indications, Prime Minister Abbott is intending to take that step slowly. Of us, I think that might well be a good thing.
That's former Prime Minister Julia Gillard. She was earlier this evening in conversation with journalist and commentator Anne Summers, editor and publisher of the online magazine Anne Summers Reports. Julia Gillard was also taking questions from the live audience at the Sydney Opera House, but we'll have to leave the Q&A session there. As I mentioned earlier, a podcast of the entire proceedings, including the full audience Q&A, will be available on the Big Ideas website tomorrow. And apologies for those slight audio dropouts. They were unfortunately unavoidable. They just came down the line from the Opera House. Thanks to the Big Ideas TV crew for all of their help. You can watch the video version of tonight's interview on their website, which you'll find a link to on our website, abc.net.au/radionational. Just head to the program menu and search for Big Ideas.
On Future Tense this week, we discover that the idea of play is more than just fun and games. In fact, a sense of playfulness may underpin the modern world. From information sharing to social activism to business training, the dynamics of play are becoming increasingly important in our rapidly evolving lives. Getting Serious About Play on Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.